independent countries, like what happened in Iraq when the IAEA provided Iraq's nuclear scientists' information to Israel. Similar actions were taken by the agency. We saw that every time Grossi visited Russian nuclear plants, Zaporizhia and Kursk, NATO forces attacked these sites and Russian defenses after he provided coordinates. This alone shows Grossi is a multi-sided spy, and the IAEA is essentially an intelligence service.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Tehran Times: Araghchi urges UN to hold Israel and US accountable for their aggression. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has formally called on the United Nations Security Council to recognize the Zionist regime and the United States as perpetrators of an act of aggression against Iran and to hold them accountable under international law. In a detailed letter addressed to UN Security General Antonio Guterres and Security Council President Carolyn Rodriguez Burkett, Araghchi warned that the attacks carried out by Israel and supported by Washington between June 13th and 24th constitutes a blatant violation of the UN Charter and multiple binding international agreements. The Israel regime's military aggression deliberately targeted residential areas, civilian infrastructure, and public services, including hospitals and relief centers, the letter stated. Araghchi emphasized that these acts not only breach international and humanitarian law, but also represent serious violations of the fundamental right to life as enshrined in Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. He further highlighted that several Iranian nuclear facilities under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, including sites in Qom, Arak, Natanz, and Isfahan, were attacked, adding that these actions also violate the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, IAEA regulations, and related UN resolutions. The Guardian: Benjamin Netanyahu corruption trial delayed on diplomatic and security grounds. The Israeli court's decision to cancel this week's hearing in the long-running trial came after Donald Trump said the case should be thrown out. An Israeli court has canceled this week's hearings in Benjamin Netanyahu's long-running corruption trial, accepting a request made by the Prime Minister on classified diplomatic and security grounds. It comes after Donald Trump last week called for the case to be thrown out. In remarks on social media, the U.S. president suggested the trial could interfere with Netanyahu's ability to join negotiations with Hamas and Iran, adding that the U.S. was not going to stand for the continued prosecution, prompting Netanyahu to thank him in a message on X. Mehr News: IAEA inspectors cannot enter Iran nuclear facilities, Iravani. Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations, Amir Said Iravani, says that IAEA inspectors are currently not able to enter Iran's nuclear facilities. In remarks made to Al-Monitor in an interview published Thursday, Ambassador Iravani declared, "Iran continues to insist that enrichment must take place on its own soil." The comment comes on the heels of a halt in fighting that ended the Israeli regime's 12-day war on Iran, which ranged from June 13th to 24th. Reuters: IAEA chief says Iran could be enriching uranium within months. Iran could be producing enriched uranium in a few months, the head of the UN nuclear watchdog Rafael Grossi was quoted as saying on Sunday, raising doubts about how effective U.S. strikes to destroy Tehran's nuclear program have been. U.S. officials have stated that their strikes obliterated key nuclear sites in Iran, although U.S. President Donald Trump said on Friday he would consider bombing Iran again if Tehran is enriching uranium to worrisome levels. The capacities they have are there. They can have, you know, in a matter of months, I would say, a few cascades of centrifuges spinning and producing enriched uranium or less than that, Grossi told CBS News in an interview. Anadolu Agency: Iran warns of crushing response if attacked again, slams Trump's remarks as nonsense. Brigadier General Ramazan Sharif, spokesperson for the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, dismissed Trump's recent statements as nonsense, saying they were the result of a heavy defeat to Iran. If Iran's national interests and assets are attacked again, our response this time will be different, more crushing and destructive, and could accelerate the collapse of the American regime, Sharif warned in a statement broadcast by the Iranian Fars News Agency. The comment came after Trump on Friday sharply criticized the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, warning that he would consider bombing the country again if Tehran continued enriching uranium. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. This series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
They said it was impossible that Israel's million-dollar missile shield would stop anything from anywhere. Then came Iran's missiles, homegrown, defiant, and precise. They broke through not with miracles, but with calculation and resolve. How did a country under the so-called crippling sanctions challenge the tech fortress of a global power? And what does this mean for future warfare?
On the first day, we used our older generation missiles, but each day we revealed a new trump card. On the fifth day of the war, when they asked if Israel wanted a ceasefire, Trump said, "Why would Israel want a ceasefire when they have the upper hand?" But on the 12th day, they came begging and requested a ceasefire.
It began with Israel's bold announcement. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared that Israel would achieve nothing short of a sweeping transformation in West Asia, starting with the destruction of Iran's nuclear program, paving the way for the so-called regime change in Tehran. We also talked to Ms. Afifeh Abedi, an Iranian journalist and a researcher on foreign policy. What were some of the Israeli-American objectives of this war, and to what extent do you think they achieved their goals?
The Americans and Israelis realized they could not achieve all their goals, like completely shutting down Iran's nuclear program and removing enriched uranium through negotiation. They wanted to extract all concessions from Iran without giving anything in return. This is one reason they attacked Iran and targeted our nuclear facilities. Another reason is to weaken Iran's unique regional position. Iran, regardless of its nuclear capabilities, holds a prominent political, economic, and geopolitical status that has often blocked Western hegemony. This was another motive for the US and Israel to deliver a heavy blow to Iran through war and, if possible, achieve their long-held dream of regime change. But in reality, this was just wishful thinking.
But just 12 days later, the war came to an abrupt halt. Pressure from U.S. President Donald Trump pushed Netanyahu to accept a ceasefire, an attempt to save the regime and to prevent the U.S. from getting deeper into the conflict. Why do you think the war didn't last for long? I mean, after 12 days, the Israeli side accepted or perhaps suggested a ceasefire.
As American sources have revealed, this 12-day war was a calculated operation they had been preparing for years, but they made many miscalculations. They mistakenly believed that once a foreign agent started the war, Iran would descend into chaos and civil war, enabling them to quickly reach their political and military goals. This was merely an illusion. They also thought that surprising Iran would finish the job. Iran, which was preparing to negotiate with the US, was caught off guard by the attack, but gradually took control and responded powerfully to Israel and the US. That's why, after 12 days, they asked for a ceasefire, presumably to regroup and rethink their strategy.
In those intense days of conflict, American bombers targeted Iran's key nuclear sites, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. But questions quickly emerged about whether these strikes had dealt any decisive blow to Iran's nuclear program. A leaked CNN report sourced from U.S. military intelligence suggested that the damage to Iran's nuclear program might be short-lived. Iran could rebuild in a matter of months. The leak sent shockwaves through the American media landscape, angering President Trump, who launched a fierce campaign against CNN and others for casting doubt on the success of the operation. The tension between official narratives and media reports highlighted a deeper divide over the true impact of the attack and the public's perception of the war's outcome. Meanwhile, Mr. Jamshidpour drew our attention to an interesting point.
Iran has pursued peaceful nuclear technology for decades, long before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, as a necessary means for national development. Even under Mohammad Reza Shah, who was essentially a U.S. puppet, America opposed its use of this technology. Consequently, Iran sought help from the Soviet Union and France to develop its nuclear facilities. Interestingly, the Americans even opposed the steel industry under the Shah, prompting him to turn against to the USSR. In short, the U.S. has opposed Iran's industrial advancement before and after the revolution, now using every pretext to stop the nuclear industry. Recently, with greater control over the IAEA, they have tried to pressure Iran through influence on the agency's reports.
But the military dynamics told a different story. Despite damage to its infrastructure, Iran launched an effective missile counteroffensive, striking Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities. Israel's anti-missile system struggled to cope with Iran's precise strikes, and reports indicated that Israel's stockpile of interceptors were rapidly depleting. Meanwhile, Israel's much-hyped objectives, disrupting Iran's nuclear program and achieving regime change, remained unfulfilled. The Iranian response was coordinated, targeted, and devastating. In less than 2 weeks, Iran had crippled the backbone of Israel's military and technological command. These are some of the targets Iran hit. The Kirya, Israel's version of the Pentagon. Camp Moshe Dayan, a training center for intelligence officers. Tel Naf Air Base, home to long-range F-15s. Nevatim and Hadzerim, bases for F-35 stealth jets. Ovda, a command and control center. But Iran didn't stop at airfields. Cyber warfare hubs in Be'er Sheba, including the Gav Yam Negev Tech Park. Energy infrastructure, Haifa, Hadera, Ashdod. Mossad headquarters in Herzliya, the Interior Ministry, Ben Gurion Airport, even near Netanyahu's family villa in Caesarea.
The Israelis came in with all their power and years of planning, backed by the U.S. Trump was openly involved, even telling Tehran to evacuate. The Americans thought the Israelis could fight Iran alone. But when Israel began to crumble, they themselves had to openly join the war alongside NATO, with full military might, weapons and fighter jets to intercept Iranian missiles and drones. But the defensive and offensive weakness of NATO, Israel, and the US became clear, and the superiority of Iranian weaponry was evident worldwide. The world saw how we resisted with our indigenous weapons and brought them to their knees.
Back in the occupied territories, economic damage in Israel was severe, with estimates ranging from $3 to $5.3 billion in initial losses. How do you assess the deterrence power of Iran's missiles?
After Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran, the defense doctrine of the Islamic Republic became deeply intertwined with self-reliance. The Iranians realized they could not depend on others to defend their land and had to achieve self-sufficiency in defense. The effectiveness of Iranian forces in defending the country against Israeli and American attacks can be heard from CENTCOM commanders and veteran U.S. soldiers who were surprised by the intensity and precision of Iran's response, especially in the war's final hours when the Israeli regime and its allies, despite having the most advanced military equipment, could do little to counter Iran's retaliatory strikes. Before direct confrontation, Israelis mocked Iran's missile capabilities, calling it a bluff. But after Operation Promise 1 and 2, and especially Operation Promise 3, which inflicted heavy blows on Israel, they realized the true extent of Iran's deterrent power. Their desperate plea for a ceasefire after 12 days said it all.
As the war ended, it was clear that Israel's military ambitions had faltered, and the political fallout could be significant. What happens next for Netanyahu? And what does this war mean for the future of West Asian geopolitics? The enemies were expecting applause. Instead, they faced resistance. When foreign forces struck Iran, they weren't met with surrender, but solidarity. They miscalculated badly. The attacks didn't trigger what they call regime change. It crushed the illusion that it ever could. In fact, the American-Israeli fantasy met the hard truth of national unity, as always. On June 28th, Saturday morning, Tehran streets filled with tens of thousands of mourners, honoring the victims of Israel's 12-day war against Iran. The procession, described as historic, paid tribute to 60 martyrs, including top military commanders and nuclear scientists, all killed in the war. The atmosphere was one of defiance and resolve as the crowd chanted slogans condemning Israel and the United States. It was a powerful display of national unity.
In an utterly shameless way, so-called human rights advocates and defenders of international law have trampled on every rule, law, and international obligation and continue to do so. We still witness bizarre statements and positions from Western countries. For example, the German Chancellor openly said, Israel is doing the dirty work on behalf of them, showing they have no commitment to moral principles or international rules and openly admit it. In France, statements from officials clearly support the illegal and aggressive attacks of the Zionist regime. This justification and normalization of crimes is itself the worst crime.
Despite the war's devastating toll, it galvanized Iranians, uniting them, even those critical of the government, against external aggression. In the end, Iran emerged from the conflict, bruised but emboldened. Israel, facing unexpected costs and the U.S. seen as reckless, found their regional influence severely diminished.
Over the past 2 years, the Zionist regime, backed by the U.S. and parts of NATO, has carried out a series of actions aimed at changing the geopolitical landscape of the region. In other words, they seek to fragment the region and implement their so-called Greater Middle East or American Middle East plan, which was unveiled in 2000. However, its execution has faced a major obstacle known as the resistance axis, led by Iran. Therefore, an attack on Iran, with the goal of weakening and dividing it, has always been on the table for the Americans and Israelis. Of course, Iran has always been aware of this and has calibrated its defensive capabilities accordingly, so that whenever the U.S. and Israel decide to strike, it can defend itself, something we witnessed clearly in the recent war.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
By the stars and how they are fixed, unlike the tears we cry, we'll continue to lament him long after we all die, long after we all die, devoid of all our worries, the ashes of our bodies shall all recite the melodies of Hosea's tragedies.
Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein.
Hussein's day is not a day, his day makes the year sway. And if love can take away breath, his love takes souls away. His love takes souls away.
shall never set. Drowning, we were saved by him, our rock of salvation. God placed his love for Hussein within our creation, within our creation. And so towards him we're drawn, his arm upon our eyes drawn. The Lord had created the so that for him we mourn.
Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein.
We won't forget Hussein's wound, the 1700, nor shall his 72 be lost for a second, be lost for a second. And the 6-month-old infant, and the scorched and the burning tent, against the face of tyrants, for them all we lament.
We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein.
If our legs were taken away, to your grave we would crawl. Your grave became a Kaaba, that even the stars circle, that even the stars circle. The wounds from which you would ache, a house of God they would make, for God's pleasure and your sake, we'd come crying love.
We will never forget Hussein.
A promise to your mother and to her rib broken, we'll remember till the earth by this love is shaken. By this love is shaken. One day beside her lost son, shall mourn her martyr son, that from our skies is gone.
Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. Abad wallah ya Zahra, ma ninsa Husayna. We will never forget Hussein. We will never forget Hussein.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran. We're glad to have you with us. We start off with our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have A to Z of Life. As the name suggests, this program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as sharing some inspirational poetry and stories with us. And our final program this hour is again our radio productions feature.
عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
May peace, blessings, and mercy from God be with you. When discussing Iran in the context of the war in June 2025, it's essential to highlight two individuals who played a key role in enhancing the chances of success for the Axis and in bringing closer the dream of liberating Palestine, the martyr Qasem Soleimani and the martyr Saeed Izadi, also known as Hajj Ramadan. General Soleimani, the former commander of the Quds Force, was the true architect behind the evolution of the resistance axis. He transformed what was once a simple defensive alliance of forces in the region into a concrete project aimed at besieging Israel and challenging American supremacy in our countries. Soleimani played a crucial role in reinforcing the two central ideas of the Axis strategy. His involvement in organizing the arms routes for the resistance in Palestine is significant and well documented by numerous statements from Palestine and Lebanese leaders. Additionally, Hajj Qasem led the mission to combat Daesh in Iraq and Syria. In doing so, he eliminated the most lethal American grip, which aimed to dismantle societies and pit forces against those who opposed hegemony and occupation in endless battles. This would allow Israel to expand discreetly and enable the United States to maintain its dominance without disruptions. By defeating Daesh, Soleimani, in collaboration with Iraqi, Syrian, and Lebanese forces, helped to strengthen the umbrella that protected the Palestinian resistance and establish a balance against the dominant American power. In all these events, the media outlets of the normalizing regimes, whether Saudi, Emirati, or Qatari, were at the forefront. They promoted the term Iranian project as an initiative aimed at occupying Arab territories and perpetrating sectarian massacres. The aim of this campaign was to create a link between the Zionist project and the so-called Iranian project, as they defined it. Their direct message to the Arab audience was, as an Arab, what is your issue with the Zionist project? It occupies territories. If that's the case, then this Iranian project also occupies four Arab capitals. And if your concern is that American hegemony imposes a lifestyle on you and erases your identity and existence, then this Iranian project turns Arab peoples into Persians, magicians, and fire worshippers. This is how media controlled by normalizing regimes instill this idea in the minds of their followers. The goal was to create a demon that was equal to and even worse than the one already known to Arabs and Muslims, Israel. In the face of a supposedly worse demon than Israel, it becomes normalized and natural to ally with the lesser demon, meaning Israel, or at least to collaborate with it to combat the Iranian project. It becomes quite common and natural to view oneself, at best, as neutral and to pray. It becomes quite common and natural to view oneself, at best, as neutral and to pray, oh God, punish the oppressors with the oppressors. This distortion of consciousness, which occurred and continues to occur under the guise of the Iranian project, is the reason why many people were left shocked after the Zionist Western aggression against Iran in June 2025, particularly following the harsh and destructive Iranian responses to the Israeli entity. However, this shock, even today, has not managed to overcome the vast amount of falsehoods and lies that have been spread about leaders of the Axis of Resistance as a whole, and specifically about the Iranian leaders. When an Arab observer sees that an Iranian general named Abbas Nil Furushan was martyred in Beirut alongside Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and other martyrs, or that an Iranian Islamic leader named Qasem Soleimani was treacherously killed by the United States in Baghdad along with Iraqi leader Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and several of his companions, or that an Iranian Islamic leader named Mohammad Reza Zahidi was martyred in the Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus in 2024, the media promoting the normalization of relations with Israel convinces this Arab observer to regard these matters as marginal and insignificant details. The aim is to persuade the Arab observer that the presence and influence of these leaders actually serve as proof of an alleged Iranian occupation of Arab capitals. It is both paradoxical and sorrowful that the actions of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps of Iran across all areas of the resistance axis have been supported and even led by the country's own population. However, the media of the normalizing regimes continue to try to convince the observer that as an Arab, it's impossible to act independently. They want to instill the belief that it is unfeasible to work on a project for the liberation of Palestine or to form alliances based on this aspiration. Instead, one must believe that they are merely a tool serving what they call the Iranian project. Even when the Al-Qassam brigades carried out the Operation Al-Aqsa flood, the primary and most prominent accusation was aimed at Iran, claiming that Hamas's actions were intended to further the Iranian agenda. Similarly, during the July 2006 war, some in Lebanon, aligned with the normalizing regimes, believed that the war was waged by the Lebanese resistance solely as a result of the nuclear negotiations between Iran and the West. To uncover the truth behind the Iranian project, it's crucial to discuss a second key figure, Muhammad Saeed Izadi, or Hajj Ramadan, who was assassinated by Israel during the aggression against Iran in June 2025. According to published reports, his official obituary and statements from the Palestinian resistance, especially from the Al-Qassam brigades, indicated that he was the head of the Palestinian file in the Quds force of the IRGC. This man, whose real name and detailed role we learn after his assassination, is testified by all leaders and members of the Palestinian factions. In 1992, he traveled to Lebanon, to the Marj al-Zahur region in the southeast, to meet with Palestinian leaders who had been deported by the occupation. Hajj Ramadan's meeting with Palestinian officials conveyed a singular message: the absolute commitment of Iran, and particularly the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, to support the will of the Palestinian people. According to the testimonies from leaders of Palestinian factions and Israel's own accusations against Hajj Ramadan, this man was responsible for financing, arming, and training members of the Palestinian resistance. He personally oversaw the development of smuggling networks for weapons and money into Palestine. The promise that Hajj Ramadan made in 1992 to a group of exiled leaders from movements that barely had individual weapons was fulfilled over 33 years. Thus, the Palestinian factions transformed into a regional force capable of attacking Tel Aviv and executing operations on the scale of the Operation Al-Aqsa flood. The story of Hajj Ramadan, along with other unknown narratives and details that have yet to be disclosed to the media, confirms one thing: the Iranian project is both real and existent. However, contrary to what the normalizing regime's media claim, this is a revolutionary initiative aimed at breaking the American hegemony over our nation. Its goal is to enhance our chances, those of the people in this region, the Arabs, to liberate our land and regain sovereignty over our resources and wealth. For this reason, the U.S. Zionist war against Iran in June 2025 was unavoidable. The Iranian nuclear project appeared to be the main driver of this war, but its primary goal was and continues to be to undermine the foundations of the Resistance Axis project. Essentially, it aims to dismantle Iran's initiative to support the Arab liberation movement, thereby strengthening the existing siege against the resistance forces in Palestine, Lebanon, and throughout the region. What the United States and Israel desire is an Iran that functions as an agent and the tool of the West, just as it did during the Shah's era, when normalizing regimes not only accepted it, but were also subservient to it. What the West and Israel demand from Iran is for it to weaken and exhaust itself, raising the flag of surrender. At this moment, that would mean denying Palestine, abandoning the resistance project, and isolating itself within its own borders. For this reason, we can understand the current war against Iran primarily from a civilizational perspective. It is a war between a brutal force that believes it has the right to bomb nuclear facilities and endanger the lives of millions, including the citizens that are subordinate to the governments, and a force that stands up for its right to be a rival to the West and to uphold sovereignty over its resources and the energy of its people. The war is fought between a barbaric model willing to burn and destroy a country filled with cultural treasures, as seen in Iraq, Syria, and throughout all of our nations, and a society stubbornly rooted in history, unwilling to give up its status as a noble nation, deserving of respect and not begging for life from the arrogant West. One of the most striking events that emerged following the escalation of U.S. Zionist aggression against Iran was the spread of tweets from the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in English, addressing social and philosophical issues. The significant admiration these tweets garnered from the Western public, including those in the United States, encapsulates part of the civilizational aspect of the current war. This is a struggle between a brutal force rooted in ignorance, slavery, exploitation, and genocide, and a force that seeks liberation while insisting on upholding its moral and ethical principles. Showcasing a revolutionary experience that refuses to submit to hegemony and arrogance. The war against the Iranian project signifies a turning point between two eras, one of total submission to hegemony and another of renewed momentum for the liberation project. This happens despite all the sacrifices and blows our peoples have endured since 1948 and since World War I, particularly concentrated in the last 2 years, namely after the Operation Al-Aqsa flood. We, the peoples of the region and all the free nations of the world, will gain immensely from the strength and victory of Iran. It'll be a joy as great as that which filled the hearts and cheers of the people of Gaza with every barrage of rockets fired at the positions of the Israeli occupation. The Iranian Project, the title of our episode today, can be summarized with the words written by the martyr Mostafa Chamran in his memoirs. I lived a comfortable life in the United States and had all the opportunities, but I divorced myself from pleasures. I traveled to southern Lebanon, where I live among the needy and oppressed, experiencing their poverty and hardships, and opening my heart to the pain and concerns of these unfortunate people. I always wanted to confront the threat of death under Israeli bombs. The Iranian Project is also encapsulated in a tweet from the account of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Amidst the intense barbaric bombings against Iran and at the peak of the threat to the Iranian state structure itself, as well as the personal threat to the leader Ayatollah Khamenei, he declared on June 21, 2025, "The Palestinian cause is essential to us, and the victory of Palestine is unavoidable." See you next week, God willing.
Challenges, nothing in life is free. not the way it was. Help me find my way. My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too just get
this is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the middle way. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on Iron Bingish Radio. Me, Sister Zainab. And obviously the middle way is... it's another huge topic in our faith, and obviously we know that Islam is not a faith of extremes. We're all supposed to follow the middle way, the moderate path, and so neither tending to extreme on the one side nor on the other side. I'm just going to illustrate this just with a little sort of anecdote from life of one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Defense by the name of Manucher Mordek. So obviously he, like all martyrs, and like the most self-reformed, the most pious amongst us Muslims and believers, didn't like extremes in his affairs, and to such an extent even that he wouldn't talk that much. And so obviously this is a different way of looking at this sort of middle way, because typically, or very often when we were talking about the middle way and not going towards extremes, often it seems to be centered, focused on, you're not being ostentatious, not showing off our wealth, not being overly wealthy. But of course, in Islam, there's no problem with people having wealth and being wealthy. It's more about how, what we do with it, and whether we show it in an ostentatious way. So that's obvious, but obviously this idea of the moderate path has many other different sort of aspects to it. And I think maybe it's quite useful to even talk about this idea that, we don't even talk too much, because this is something that is reflected in our teachings, and the scholars tell us we're supposed to weigh our words carefully. We are not supposed to actually talk too much, because the danger is the more we talk, maybe we end up talking nonsense too. That's just something that sometimes happens. And there's other elements in there which I'll explain. Welcome back to AZ here on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that Islam has the middle way. And I mentioned this of particular attitude or behavior of the famous martyr Manuel Chermodek, who wouldn't even talk too much. And maybe think about it for yourselves. What is it like? Obviously we all mix with families and friends or in the workplaces. And just think to yourselves, what is it like when you're with people and, they just don't stop talking? And then what is it like when we're with people and we understand and we sort of can sort of tell that they're really only sort of trying to say the most important things. So there's no sort of superfluous and silly stuff in there. And they do actually pause, because, of course, the danger is if we're talking too much, if we're extreme even in our amount of conversation, how is the other person going to even be able to converse with us? I mean, how long do they have to wait? Because obviously, if we have good akhlaq, we're not supposed to sort of interrupt the other person. But if that person just talks and talks and talks, and for sure everyone knows people like that in their surroundings, family or friends or workplace, it's difficult. So this is also, in a sense, being kind, having politeness, being humble towards others, that we are aware, well, hang on, there's another person there. A conversation is a two-way process. It's not just about one person talking. And obviously we have to think about, we really want our words to have some significance, to be useful in the sense that maybe there's something informative and sort of educational in our words, maybe useful in that they give light to the hearts of other people. That could also be very beautiful. But let's just leave it that obviously here in the podcast I have to keep talking at you. But inshallah we can sort of be a bit more aware of that we don't just talk at or over people. Inshallah. So look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
people that wanted to visit the city of Shiraz would go through the Quran gate. But nowadays, with the volume of cars, only people pass. Join me as I visit the city of Shiraz.
The Quran gate is the first thing you'll notice as you enter the city from the north, as two old copies of Islam's holy book was kept here in the past. Just at the entrance of the city also lies the statue of Haju Kermani, a poet and mystic from the 14th century. His poems are mostly about spirituality. His works are believed to have influenced another Iranian poet called Hafiz, which we'll get to later in this program. Haju Kermani traveled to many lands during his time, but that stopped when he came to Shiraz.
The city of Shiraz is known for its poets and poetry. Many renowned Iranian poets lived here. Haju Kermani, when he visited the city of Shiraz, he never left.
This is likely because the rulers of this land valued arts.
The Arg of Karim Khan is a citadel built during the 18th century as the living headquarters of Karim Khanezan himself. Later it was a prison, and now it's a museum, which we can enter.
Karim Khanezan founded the Zand dynasty and declared Shiraz his capital, and thus many buildings were erected in this city during his rule.
The architecture of the citadel combines military and residential architecture, as it was the home of Karim Khanezan and also the head of his military headquarters.
But Karim Khan was different from other rulers of the time. When he came to power, he refused to be called king. He accepted the title, the Advocate of the People, that is Vakil in Persian. Many structures built during his time carry Vakil in their name. Stained glass goes hand in hand with Iranian architecture. From homes to palaces, most windows were decorated this way. But it wasn't just for beauty.
The interesting thing about tinted glass is it's first soothing for the environment and for the eyes, and also it keeps the insects away, they say. I don't see any insects here, do you?
Next stop is the Vakil Bathhouse, a place where people from all walks of life would chit-chat and also bathe. At the entry, every part of the society had their own section, and many of the people's problems were resolved just here. It was like the city's or the town's informal council. And about the building itself,
bathhouse. And even in this building, which is a bathhouse, there's lots of detail put in the architecture. So this shows you how much Iranians valued every single building, even a bathhouse. Let's go and check out the rest.
Walking through this bath, I saw wall after wall of detail put in the making. And it's quite big for a place to bathe. But this also shows this place was more like a hangout or a place they would spend hours in. Not just a quick shower like we do today. And may I remind you, they didn't shower every day in the old days.
This place was way more than a bathhouse. Like, for example, one person's having a scrub, the other's having a massage, and of course, one of them is bathing. And on the other side, there's one person getting a haircut, a shave, and that guy there got his tooth pulled out.
The Vakil Mosque is another landmark of Shiraz. The 48 columns in its prayer hall, carved in spirals, are one of its outstanding features. Next is Bazar-e Vakil, a big market still in use today to find everything from Shiraz and beyond. From spices and herbs to sweets and confectionery, and many, many more, this is the place to visit. You can find every kind of souvenir here, many cool things you can buy. And every quarter has its own goods. One unique part in this bazaar is where several hallways meet.
Okay, many of Iran's bazaars are similar in shape, but the difference for the bazaar in Shiraz is this little part here is called the Saray-e Murshid, where you can get your hands on many little things like little antiques, little jewelry, or little souvenirs where you can take home.
Talking about cool things, there was also an antique shop that topped my list. The Vakil Bazaar is one of the longest stretching and most famous bazaars in Iran. It is located in the center of Shiraz and is amongst Iran's national heritage sites. Saadi, another one of the renowned poets of this land. He was born in Shiraz. He spent more than 2 decades traveling outside of Persia following the Mongol invasion. His works reflect upon the lives of ordinary people suffering displacement, agony, and conflict. His best-known works, Bustan, meaning the orchard, and Golestan, the rose garden, consist of stories illustrating the standard virtues recommended to Muslims, being justice, kindness, modesty, and gratification.
Saadi is one of the most famous Iranian poets of all time. His poetry is seen all over the world, not just in Iran. One of the verses that is seen in the UN building in New York is, "All men and women are to each other the limbs of a single body, each of us drawn from life's shimmering essence, God's perfect pearl. And when this life we share wounds one of us, all share the hurt as if it were our own. You who will not feel another's pain, you forfeit the right to be called human." This was just one.
And talking about flowers and gardens, the city of Shiraz is also famous for its Persian gardens. And in spring, the scent of flowers fills the sky in this city. The whole city is like a big flower shop. And last but not least is Persian poet Hafez. He was a spiritual poet and mystic known by his pen name Hafez. It means a person that knows the Quran by heart. It is believed that he also knew the works of Saadi, Rumi, and several other poets by heart too. His mausoleum located in a garden is where people gather to recite his poems, relax, and enjoy the environment. It's a popular hangout for artists in Shiraz.
Hafez, one of the most prominent Iranian poets of all time. While he passed away several centuries ago, still you can find his poems in the homes of Iranians today. So this shows